From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Friday morning on the front page of the New York Times. A single photo took up much of that front page space, and that photo has captured the attention of the world. It's an image of a 5-year-old Syrian boy named Amran Dakhnish. Now, you've probably seen it. The boy is dazed, sitting in the back of an ambulance. At first glance, if you just kind of come upon the photo and you're not looking directly at it, it might appear to be mostly black and white photograph with only a splash of orange for the seat the boy is sitting on. But look closer, and you see that the boy is covered in dust, with dark red blood matted to his head. He has survived a bombing, the attack hitting the building in which his family lived. His 10-year-old brother would die from his wounds. But here's the question about Omran and this photo. Why did this photo go viral? The Times has covered the war in Syria with literally hundreds of photographs and stories. What was it about this particular image that haunted and shocked and saddened the world? Times photo editor Craig Allen addressed that question on Monday, but admitted, quote, it's a difficult question for even the most seasoned photo editor to answer, end quote. And there are cameras everywhere these days. Most of our phones can capture images. This year, though, we've been reminded that the ubiquity of cameras does not eliminate the need for professional, journalistically minded photographers. Take the case of the woman in Baton Rouge, standing calmly with her summer dress billowing, with two police officers in riot gear preparing to arrest her. That image captured some of the dissonance that the African-American community feels in their relations with police. This hour, a discussion about the power of photography and the continuing need for professional photographers. They are still employed, maybe not in the same numbers. We'll talk about that, too. But my guests include Max Schulte, Democrat and Chronicle lead photographer. And Max does some of the really, really good work in this town journalistically. It's always nice to talk to you, Max. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
William Snyder's here, and he is a 4-time Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer and chair of the photojournalism program at the Rochester Institute of Technology. William, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And Jen Poggi's here. Jen is a former deputy director of the White House Photo Office and an RIT assistant professor. Jen, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And just to kind of clear up, someone say, deputy director of the White House Photo Office, less of a journalistic mission and more of a historical mission, your work there. Can you tell us a little bit about your work you did for the White House?
Yes, absolutely. The mission of the White House Photo Office was to document the president and his administration for historical purposes. The goal is to build an archive, a comprehensive archive. It's part of the Presidential Records Act. All of the images are preserved for historical purposes and will ultimately end up as a part of the National Archives and the Presidential Library.
You traveled some?
I did.
Mostly internationally or domestically?
Mostly internationally, some domestically, but mostly internationally.
Did you enjoy it?
Yes, I loved it.
Yeah. Well, so now are you let's say, more comfortable, or was it just sort of a departure or just a different set of mission ideas for what you're doing there? Again, less of a journalistic photojournalism and more about historical. I'm wondering how that sort of differed versus, photojournalism.
Well, it's important to draw the distinction.
Sure.
But for me, it was a natural transition in that I was using, as many of us were using, our journalistic skills to document and to preserve. I was using my editing skills, the same editing skills that I would use, in journalistic ventures. But yeah, it's definitely important to draw the distinction. And my goal, my primary goal, at the end of the day, was to preserve an archive for historical purposes.
I want to start by asking the panel about this image that sparked the discussion, and then there's a lot more to talk about. But the same question that the New York Times' Craig Allen was trying to grapple with in what he wrote on Monday. Why this one? Why this particular image? Max Schulte, why did this image go viral when so many others? There are, in my mind, equally haunting and sad images of children being rescued, pulled out of rubble, a baby being hustled out of a bombed building. Why this one, though?
Well, I would argue that there have been images that have spurred as much making a connection with this child, the images of children washing up on beaches.
Certainly that one. Certainly the 3-year-old boy on the beach.
Obviously no spurred question. Quite a bit of reaction from viewers in Europe. I think we're now having that same kind of effect here with this image in America and all over the world. But as a parent, if you have children, you can't help but look at this image and think, what if that was my child? And I think that's probably the connection that people are making with this photo is that people who you know have raised their children or have children are looking into this kid's eyes and making a connection, and they're feeling something that they haven't felt from the other ones. And that's probably what has sparked this image to be somewhat the iconic image out of this right now.
Yeah. William, what do you think?
Well, I think if you look at sort of like both of those images, the child on the beach and this one, they're very simple images. You know, there's nothing else distracting you to your attention. You're focused on that child. And in this particular instance, you know, you have nothing to look at really but their eyes to begin with. And so at his eyes. And I think that connection, same thing with the beach. You know, you look at the child's face and, you know, you're there. You don't have destroyed backgrounds. You don't have lots of other people. You're just focused in on this one child. And I think it's the simplicity of the image that makes it so powerful. Plus, you know, it moved around social media really fast before the mainstream media got their hands on it. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps with it, too.
Jen, what do you think?
I would echo what William has to say about its simplicity. I think that some of the most powerful images that resonate with the public are images that are otherwise mundane situations. Not to say that the situation in Aleppo is in any way mundane, yet the simplicity of the boy in the back of this ambulance is a scenario that we could somehow imagine ourselves being in. And the horror and the you know, we can relate in some way or imagine ourselves in some way in that particular set of circumstances. I also think that the video that accompanied that image, yep, is a crucial part of this particular image because, you know, we see, especially on social media, but also in the articles that have been written, we see that accompanying the still image. And so we see the boy's movement. We see how disoriented he is. And I think that adds, you know, he's quiet, and there's the quiet sense about him, you know, really portrays the shock that we imagine him to be going through. People have commented about the way he wipes the dust and blood off next to him. It's sort of a matter-of-factly, and I think that's very powerful. It resonates.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And a little bit more from Craig Allen at the Times, in part of his conclusion to what maybe sparked such interest in this particular image over others, is that it seems to strike this balance between grisly but not overly gory to the point where it can be shared in a lot of venues without being considered over the top, and yet showing you enough of the devastation to be sort of shocking and realistic. And here's what Craig writes. He writes, "The Omran picture delivers a shock to the conscience but also strikes that balance, delivering a sharp message and being too difficult to view. It is compelling but not grisly. It can enter an Instagram feed or a Facebook wall. It can arouse sympathy, be shared, and allow the viewer to move on without seeing the absolute worst of what war has to offer." You're nodding, Jen. You agree with that?
I do agree with that. You know, when I saw the image, it reminded me back in 2001, following the 9/11 attacks, of a Stan Honda photo of a woman. I believe she was in her late 20s at the time, and she has since passed. She passed in 2014. And she was covered in dust and residue from the collapse of the tower that she had just escaped. And it's a very simple image. And it again, I think it strikes a chord because it's not just the fact that she's covered in this residue, it's the look on her face, it's the posture, you know, the way she's holding herself that I think really strikes and again pulls forth that feeling of shock.
I see the phone ringing already, and I should mention to listeners, if you want to join the conversation, did that image above others move you in particular? Or what is it about that maybe sparked an emotional response in you? Your take on it is welcome. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'd be remiss, even though the discussion focused this hour is on the power of photography, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that the Syrian Center for Policy Research estimated last December that the death toll after more than 5 years of war is nearly 500,000, and the United Nations places the number of children who have died in Syria in the tens of thousands. Again, Omran has survived. His 10-year-old brother died from the wounds he suffered in that bombing there. So that's something that we should know. One more bit of disclosure. I meant to read off the top, but I'll read this now just to get this out of the way. My wife is a professional photographer. She is not a news photographer. She photographs high school senior portraits. And some might argue that I've got a stake in promoting the idea that we still need professional photographers because of it. The conversation this hour is independent of my wife's field, but you can weigh that and give it whatever weight you conclude is appropriate. Before I turn to some other photographs that I think are capturing a lot of attention, I want to ask William to weigh in on some of this. I don't want to say cynicism, but the pushback. I've read headlines, people saying it shouldn't take this picture of Omran for you to realize how terrible things are. You know, in other words, this is waking you up. Get with it. The world is in real trouble. It shouldn't take this. But I read that. I don't necessarily agree with it. I think sometimes it does take a single image or a piece of video sometimes, or a particularly poignant image, to spark us, because we are busy human beings who are trying to deal with a lot in our own communities, in our own towns. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right, because, look, especially with the internet and media being what it is, we are bombarded every day with hundreds, if not thousands, of images and news coming at us, flying left and right. And it's not like the old days where there were three or four trusted, you know, purveyors of news, and you sat down and we all gathered around the TV or the radio. Now it's just hitting us from everywhere, and I think people become inured to it. And you know, I hate to say it this way, but I think we need this kind of imagery and these kind of reports to sort of shake people out of, I wouldn't say complacency, but just sort of like information overload, you know, sort of snap us out of all of this and remind us this is happening. Plus, when you think about it, you've got television and movies that depict war and that stuff, and people play violent war video games every day. And I think people have a tendency to sort of forget what it really means. Because, you know, unlike during the Vietnam era and earlier, we don't have a draft anymore. So the number of people in this country that are personally touched by war is dwindling. You know, it's a fully volunteer army, so most of us don't understand what it's like to have anything to do with this sort of thing. And, you know, and this just serves as an unfortunate but I think needed reminder. Hey, this stuff is happening, and it's not just bad guys. Look at the fallout. I mean, think about this. I think so, for example, there were a lot of people, think back to the Oklahoma City bombing. There were a lot of people sort of on, you know, in that militia side that were sort of behind Timothy McVeigh. And then that picture came out of the fireman carrying, you know, the lifeless body of that child. And then they began to talk about all the children that were killed in that, because there was a daycare center right there. And so I think, you know, to sort of remind people that these things are not simple, and they're just not good versus bad, and that the lines are drawn.
Yeah, you know, Max Schulte, I mentioned toward the top of the program, and I've talked on this program a lot about my concerns about cuts in journalism departments, because if you only had, as William says, the information overload, statistics, reports on where war fronts are, where bombing campaigns are happening, that's important. But if that's all you have and you don't have an accompanying image, that put a human face on that no one could deny, that image of Omran, 5 years old. That's a human image that cuts through all of that information overload, as William describes it, and tells you, wow, this is real. These are kids this is happening to. And that's why I worry about cuts, because I think sometimes we prioritize one over the other, and I find them going hand in hand. Do you?
You know, I think there's a lot of, I mean, obviously the media industry has taken a hit, especially newspapers, and some newspapers have made decisions that, you know, we will cut from, you know, the photography department to save some money, and we'll just outfit reporters with iPhones or small point-and-shoot cameras. And so basically what we come down to is the question of who do we entrust this work to. Can a reporter take an iPhone and go take a photo of a building for a story that we're, you know, doing in the Democrat and Chronicle about maybe some Kamaita money or something like that that's coming through for development? Absolutely. But there's a time and a place, you know, for trained photojournalists to come in and help tell the stories of our community over just an iPhone photo. And that's kind of where we step in. And that's, you know, not just the technical training behind how to use a camera. It's, you know, a degree from RIT that I have. I had professors, you know, teaching me ethics and, you know, best practices and, you know, how to go about doing the job in a responsible way so that when I do bring something to our community, a photo to our community, you know, they can trust that what I'm bringing to them is, you know, an accurate depiction of what I experienced.
Yeah, and I say this not at all to be trite, to be very sincere. Thank goodness that that you're there and you're out there working alongside some of the outstanding print reporters we have in this town. When I was at 13 WHAM News, I recall, you know, this notion that these discussions about, well, eventually everyone's going to have to be trained to shoot video, and I barely know how to white balance, you know, let alone understand differences when it came to, you know, sort of wide, medium, tight, and, you know, what kind of sequencing of shots and how to do that. Could I function? Can I hit the button and turn it on? Yes. Can I do it in a journalistic way that is trained and professional and equally powerful? No chance. So, but let's you know, I don't want to get too far off on that tangent only because, you know, we're going to get back to the, I'm going to get to your phone calls in a second. Jen wants to weigh in there too. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's interesting because there was a 2013 Pew Research report that came out that said visual journalists, not just photojournalists, but people who work in information graphics, the visual side of journalism, had lost between 2000 and 2012, 43% decrease in the number of people working in the profession. And yet that's all happening at a time where the image, still moving graphic, is sort of ubiquitous in our society. It is, you know, it transcends because of technology. You know, the need and the demand is there. So there's sort of this irony in where we're making cuts and how we're making those decisions versus the importance and the relevancy in today's climate.
I agree.
Well, let me also just jump in here and add one last little thing to echo and expand on what Max was saying. The ability, well, and you said this too, the ability to tell a story with imagery is, as a friend of ours puts it, it's a boutique skill. Making pictures is no longer that hard of a thing anymore. But to make a picture, a single image or a series of pictures or a whole big project that tells an actual story is really, really hard to do. And you echoed that even in video. And it's even harder in stills. And the world is beginning to understand that, if not outright, at least intuitively. And you know, one of the things I've always said is, okay, I understand news organizations, they want to maintain their high profit margins. Okay, fine. Well, why can't they teach some of the photographers to write? You know, it seems to me that you could probably teach the photographers to write better than you can writers to photograph, because a lot of writing is about observation. It's about what you know, details and things like that. And that's what photographers do. And I think the public really appreciates that. I mean, Jen pointed it out. I mean, in what some people are calling, you know, an increasingly post-literate society, imagery, you know, visual imagery tells stories far, far better. So why is this happening? I can't answer that.
That's a horrifying term, by the way, post-literate society. Max, do you want to jump back in real quick?
So let's face it, you know, as we talk about how we gather our news and where we find our news, it's basically we're finding that everybody goes to, you know, Twitter, Facebook, all these social media channels. And, you know, it's no longer the headline that grabs you, okay? It's the image, all right? You are drawn in via the image as to whether or not you want to read more about that story. So, you know, photography and the image is, you know, we've elevated it on these platforms where it's key. So I think there are several news organizations that are now swinging the pendulum back the other way and realizing that, look, we need to have a critical eye, whether it's an editor or a photographer or videographers. We need to have people who know how to do this, because we need to draw folks into our stories via a visual element.
All right, well, let me grab some of your phone calls here. This is Bob in Mendon first up. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, good afternoon. I get the opportunity to travel internationally a couple times a year, and I was in Europe in June and was watching news there, and it dawned on me it's the first time that I've actually seen what was going on over in Syria. They were showing both stills and video of the refugee camps and the actual conditions. They were showing the cities of where people were living that were just, you know, kind of blown to smithereens. And I don't see those images here. And it's much different when you hear about how many people are leaving, and you what we seem to be receiving here as information is numbers of how many people are leaving and where they're going from and to, and the unhappy people who are in the situation where they need to receive these people. It kind of takes the human face out of it, especially if you don't show what these groups of people look like. And I think the reason that photograph had such impact is it's, for me, one of the first times I've actually seen a photograph of what's going on over there. So it's the coverage we get here is far different. Even in Canada, it's much more detailed, and you see much more imagery than you do here.
Bob, thanks for the phone call. Let me ask our panel what they think there. So I'll start with William Snyder, who's why don't I start with a former deputy White House photo editor, who's Jen Poggi, who's traveled plenty internationally herself as well. Why don't you start there, Jen?
I think it's a really valid point by the caller. I think that I would also say that in an age where we have more information accessible to us, the onus becomes somewhat on people, on individuals, to seek out what they feel they're not getting. And the information is there, but it does require more work. I think that our mainstream media does live, especially in broadcast, but not entirely limited to broadcast. We live in a much quicker pace, where we do rely more on sound bites and quick news flashes and all of that. And there are still organizations that are doing more in-depth coverage and that are relaying that to their audience, but you do have to seek that out.
Okay. William Snyder, again, who is a four-time Pulitzer Prize winning photographer and chair of the photojournalism program at RIT.
There's this push-pull between the mainstream media and their audiences. The audiences say they want news, but then when you go and you give them hard news, people start complaining because it's too graphic or it's too down or things like that. Echo what Jen just said. Yeah, it's not just broadcast. Time Magazine publishes a U.S. edition, they publish an international edition. The cover of the international edition is always much more interesting news-wise and depicts some of the things that the reader says he doesn't see all the time. It reminds me of what the Time Magazine used to be. Mm. Now you've got all of these illustrations and all of this stuff. I mean, I think Jesus has been on the cover of Time like 15 times in the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, and portraits and soft things. They say, their research says that that's what people want to see on the cover of the magazine and will get them to pick it up and buy it at the newsstand. So whose fault is it? It's sort of like people that used to talk about the paparazzi, but they were going out and buying the Inquirer and the, News of the World every day to see the latest, embarrassing pictures of their favorite stars. You know, until the public really stands up and says, this is what I want to see, and then pays for it, I think we're going to be stuck with just looking at a lot of not newsy things.
Jesus who looks like Kenny Loggins in a hair care ad.
Exactly.
You know, which is not an accurate Jesus, by the way. That's too edited soft, which is a whole other discussion.
At least he's not blonde anymore.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I think when we see him on the covers. Let me grab Mary Howell, who's calling from Penn Yan. Go ahead, Mary Howell.
Hi. One of the concerns I have about the pictures I see, especially now that we're getting so many more pictures over Facebook and other social media, when I see children, like the little boy from Syria that was came out this week, and the little boy who was killed in the surf about a year ago, my overwhelming desire is to do something about it, to bring those children to safety, to feed them good New York food and send them to our schools and bring them to safety. And my frustration is we don't ever get information about what we Americans can do. It's not allowed. We're not allowed to sponsor a Syrian family and bring those children to safety. I think that the media is missing a golden opportunity right now to convey information. Yes, you're showing great pictures, but now what? What can we as Americans do to make this situation better? Because just showing injured children is sort of voyeurism and sensationalism if there isn't any action that those of us who are concerned can actually then go and do to make the situation better.
Mary Howell, thank you for the phone call. I think that is a series of really important and smart points to make here. I would only, I don't know if push back is the right term, but I would just say to some degree, creating attention at all is the first step toward action. There is no chance for action if there's not an awareness of a problem. And part of great photojournalism does create an awareness and a desire for action. But then, you know, Max Schulte, how do you kind of take the idea that there has to be more than just the image? There has to be an idea of what can be done, because it's complex. I mean, there's not an easy answer in Syria. But
yeah, and you know, I'm going to push back a little bit too. I mean, it's not the photographer's job to always solve the problem. The photographer, the photojournalist's job is to illustrate the problem and to show you what's going on. We have a graduate, a friend of ours, who literally ran from the Twin Towers as they fell. He's a photojournalist in New York. And as he was running, he sustained permanent eye damage to his eye and ducked inside a building and was standing with a bunch of people who had also just ran for their lives. And he started making photos of those people. They were crying. They were embracing. And one woman just looked at him and said, "Well, why are you doing this?" And he said, "So we don't forget." And that's kind of what our job is so that we don't forget, or how we go about doing our job is we're there to make sure that people don't forget. It's us as a collective society to take up a cause. If you feel something from an image, do something about it, because we've done our job. We've made you feel.
Okay. William Snyder?
Well, yeah, I mean, I echo what he says. I mean, could the media at large forget just about the photographers for a moment? Could, you know, whatever, whoever puts this picture out, you know, whether it's The Guardian or the AP or Reuters or whatever, yes, maybe they could say, you know, if you want to donate, this is what you do. But again, I'm sort of with Max. If you feel strongly enough about it, you know, it's not like the old days. There's this thing called the internet, and there's a lot of information on there. You know, and here's the other thing. I don't want to get into this too deeply, but, you know, this has also got an awful lot to do with politics. You know, when you were saying, when the caller was saying that, you know, she wants to bring them here and feed them good food and take care of them and this, that, and the other, well, there are a lot of people in this country that don't believe that, you know, and politically, you know, it's not a good thing to do. So if you really want to do something, then you've got to become politically active too in the country.
Jen Poggi?
Yeah, I would join in these comments and saying I think both of these callers have expressed you know, a desire to go deeper, and that's one of the issues that we confront as our industry changes. You know, we often, as viewers, see the breaking news, see the news that's happening on a daily basis. And sometimes what happens in an age of cuts is that our ability to dig deeper, to go beyond the headline, is diminished. And to put together these more in-depth pieces that are more explainer pieces that add greater context to what we're seeing, you know, so I would say that, you know, this is an area where, you know, I think we have to be really selective as our budgets get cut. You know, what is it that we are going to respond to, and what is it we're going to invest in covering communities both here in our own community in Rochester, statewide, nationally, and internationally? How are we going to invest our resources that we do have? And I think that's where a complement of coverage, you know, not just looking at local news where maybe the soundbite, you know, or the 30-second clip of national news or international news is just going to scratch the surface, but looking at a complement of other sources that are maybe going to go in depth, like a Frontline or, you know, some of these virtual reality packages that the New York Times is putting together, more thoughtful pieces that bring to highlight a different level of coverage.
Mary Howell, you want to follow up there?
Well, I think that when a photographer takes a picture, and I am a photographer too, so I do understand that, and then if you put it out for publication, there is some idea in the back of your mind what you're trying to convey, what you're trying to get people to notice and to feel. Whether people feel it or not, you know, that's their choice. But as a photographer, you do have an idea of what you're trying to convey. If it is something that does that should need action and response, maybe it's not the job of a photojournalist to provide that, but it certainly is the responsibility of the media in general and whatever media outlet that you're working with to give some practical information. This could be a wonderful follow-up connections. You know, how do people respond to this kind of photojournalism? And then how do they respond? How do they be effective in mm-hmm. their response?
Yeah, Mary.
Sorry, Evan, but just let me finish this.
Sure.
If a photojournalist does say, well, I'm just putting it out there, that's kind of taking the free pass as far as the bigger social responsibility of what you intend to accomplish when you take a picture that is somewhat emotional.
Yeah, Mary Hell, thank you for the phone call. And I think just to sort of clarify, her complaint at first was not about photographers, but about news organizations that may publish the work of these great photographers, these powerful images, without adding enough of a sort of a solutions-oriented journalism. That's something we talk about in our newsroom, and I think it's a very valid discussion on that. The issue, Mary Howell, I think, is it's a subjective answer in terms of what's the solution. There are people, to William Snyder's point, there are people who would have seen that image of Omran and said, that's not our problem. There are people like me who see that and have a hard time not bursting into tears thinking about that child, thinking about my son who's almost the exact same age. You know, debating with yourself, do you show your 4.5-year-old son that image? They say empathy starts at 6, but when does the world need to make sure everyone understands that our problems here may not really mirror the real problems elsewhere? It's tough, but there's not a single answer to what a solution, quote unquote, would be, I think. That makes it, you know, a little more difficult to pin down what a follow-up should be, Jen.
I think Mary's comments also strike the heart of what we're talking about here today, is that the power of photography to move people to want to do something, to move people to action. And so, you know, I think that it's an important aspect to acknowledge, and you know, how do we treat that as journalists? You know, how do we follow up? How do we provide information for the ability to follow up? And I think audiences are more sophisticated in terms of how they react to imagery, and Mary's comments echo that.
Yeah, if I could just sort of dovetail comments about this back into, you know, the original comment of why we responded to that picture. There have been studies done that show that when you show one single character, you know, and you're looking for money, people will identify with that one particular individual, usually a child, and they'll give. You add one more, and it drops to less than 50%.
Isn't that something?
And so I think part of all of this is, you know, as a society, we get turned off or bored with this stuff real fast. And again, I think an image like this, you know, again, our first two callers, I mean, you know, God bless you, do something. You know, we don't have all the answers here. Go and do the research and find something and do something about it and help, you know, help us. Our industry is getting all cut up into little pieces. It doesn't mean that good work isn't being done, but it's getting cut up into little pieces. Look at what's happening in Louisiana. It's been called the worst natural disaster in a long, long time, even larger than Katrina. One of the reasons you knew about Katrina so well is because all of us in the media at that point, we still had money and we all went down there. I know, because I had an incredible crew down there. I would say that most of the news organizations that went to Katrina are not in South Louisiana right now covering these floods. And so, you know, the world doesn't know about it as well as they did about Katrina. The Dallas Morning News isn't there. The New York Times may barely be there. The Washington Post may barely be there.
The New York Times apologized for actually not being there.
You know, so I mean, you know, I had, as a director of photography, I had a crew of 19 people, just photographers, in that region during Katrina. They don't have 19 photographers at the Dallas Morning News anymore.
These are the consequences when we don't want to pay for content and don't want to pay for journalism. That's one of them. Let's get the only break of the hour. I'm way late for that. We're coming back to your phone calls as we talk about the power of photography, particularly photojournalism. Max Schulte from the Democrat and Chronicle, he's their lead photographer. He's here. William Snyder's a four-time Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer and chairs the photojournalism program at RIT. He's here. And Jen Poggi, a former deputy director of the White House Photo Office and now an RIT assistant professor. More of your phone calls and comments next. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about how trade deals are constructed. And no, we can't peer inside the inner workings of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Many people still haven't seen it. We haven't. But when it comes to how these deals get put together to protect workers or to create standards or to protect countries, how does that happen? How is it policed? We will discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On Twitter, Matt says, I think the issue is because Omran is still alive. It's obvious he's been through hell. We've become immune to photos of war dead, including children. We see our own kids in Omran. That perhaps is right. Carol writes to us and says, one of the most haunting things about the picture of Omran is that he is so alone in that image. That little boy lying dead on the beach is tragic, but Omran is alive and alone in the back of an ambulance. That is what makes it poignant for me. I want to jump through the screen and pick him up and hug him close. That's from Carol. Also on Twitter, Kate writes to us, I totally agree with the panel. We need photographers. Two images come to my mind, the little girl from the Vietnam War and the baby from Oklahoma City. So again, these are images that have lasted the years, and we're talking about what happens well, when we cut photojournalism and when we don't, and when we still have great photojournalism. Let me read an email from another listener that I think is interesting before I get back to your phone calls. Grant writes to us and says, Evan, great discussion. It might be slightly off topic, but I think it fits. The photograph of Usain Bolt smiling at his competitors as he crossed the finish line at the Olympics was remarkable. Any one of us can take pictures with our phones, but it takes a trained photographer with an incredible eye to capture that kind of moment. And maybe some luck, too, but what an image. Thank goodness news organizations still pay photographers. That's from Grant. I think that's actually a really good point, because Usain Bolt, that'll be the most viewed image probably of his career in his lifetime, and he's one of the greatest athletes in the history of the world. And there have been uncountable number of images of him, but it was that really remarkable moment from a photographer who knew where to be and took a shot and got this incredible shot. And now we've got this indelible image of this great athlete. I thought that was interesting. On the other side of Rio, I heard Dan Patrick from NBC, well, he works for NBC as an anchor, but he hosts a radio show. He said yesterday that he was almost boasting that what a great job the photographers at NBC did, making sure the Rio you saw was beautiful, because there was still a lot of unseedy aspects of Rio. And then he said, we made Sochi look like paradise a couple of years ago, And isn't that amazing? I don't know that I would agree with his character. You're already shaking your head there, Jen. What do you think of it? I mean, I think maybe what Dan Patrick would say, who's not in the room, to be fair, is, look, we're also there to entertain you, to have fun with athletics. But I think there's still a journalistic aspect to covering the Olympic Games. And if you are boasting that you're covering Sochi or Rio in a way that makes it only look like paradise, I actually have a problem with that. Do you?
I do. I think our job as photojournalists are to cover what we see, to cover what's happening, and often without comment, allowing the people who receive those images to then glean what they see in that image. And I don't, our objective should not be to head out and make a situation appear in any particular way other than how it's happening.
Well, if I can boast a little bit about an alum who made an amazing, wonderful picture from the opening ceremonies. Mm-hmm. Mario Tama, our IT photojournalism grad, works for Getty. He went up into the favelas, and in the foreground of the picture, there's this, I think it was a courtyard, the back of a house, and you can see it's not the best of place. And in the background, you see the stadium all lit up with the fireworks and everything. And that, to me, was a beautiful image because it shows the dichotomy of what was going on in Rio. I mean, this notion of making Sochi or making Rio beautiful, quote unquote, is, to me, at the risk of annoying a lot of people, that's the difference, I think, between television and print journalism and even online journalism now, and photojournalism.
Yeah.
You know, they're more interested in pretty feel good and all of that and not reality.
I don't disagree. Max, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Jen and William. And I had seen in my social media feeds there were photographers actually down there covering the slums. Mm-hmm. There were photographers down there covering the poverty and how that juxtaposed against, obviously, these million-dollar stadiums that were built down there. I think the Olympics, you know, what that should do is then call into question, you know, who are the Olympics really serving and what good are they really doing, you know, coming to small third world countries, almost. I hate to call Brazil a third world country, but a small country that has, you know, economic issues and demanding this of countries to build this stuff when their own infrastructures are, you know, not up to par to handle it. So those are the real questions, you know, that we should be asking ourselves when we see, when we're able to juxtapose these great images of what NBC called beautiful Olympics, opposed with, you know, some of the poverty that is taking, you know, taking effect there.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. Mary Lynn in Mendon, next up. Go ahead.
Howdy, you guys. In a very interesting conversation. And I just want to second the motion from my neighbor in Mendon, who called a little while ago, saying that the news elsewhere in the world is much more in-depth and much more enlightening. So my question is for you guys, how is it that that can be the case all over Asia and all over Europe, and it isn't the case here? What is it about corporate news media here that doesn't allow that? Are you telling me that it's simply a marketing issue? And if it is a marketing issue, then how is it that it markets for more higher interest and more accuracy in Europe and in Asia and not here? Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Lynn. Who wants to start there?
You know, it is a marketing thing. News media, you know, they want to play it safe now because their profits are at stake. And, you know, they don't want to upset people. And, you know, the difference, I think, between Europe and Asia and us is that whatever in this country, people get upset pretty easily about hardcore news. You know, there's so much of it coming in, and we are so disconnected with it. It's like, well, why do I have to feel bad about this? If you're in Europe, there's all this stuff going on in Europe all the time. It's in your backyard. You sort of grow up with it. You know what it's about. Same thing in Asia. In the United States, you know, we had 9/11. It was a horrible, horrible thing, but that's a long time ago now, relatively speaking. And, you know, there was a real spike in interest in foreign news and hardcore news right after 9/11. It's like, well, why did they do this? And now it's just tapered back off, and everybody wants to feel good again.
Yeah. Jen, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think that we have, and I can't speak to other countries. I'm definitely not an expert in publications in other regions of the world. But I think what we see increasingly in the U.S. is publications being bought up by parent companies, merging, where the control of what's being covered locally and the ideas of what works in a community are, to some degree, being taken out of that community and being brought into sort of more of a national entity or a larger core entity, which is financially driven. You know, I think we look at a lot of our organizations, and if we poke around and we move up through the structure, we can see that a lot of our publications are owned by very few organizations. And so they still have an identity, but, you know, we used to have a thriving family-owned media climate in this country, or small company-owned, and we see less and less of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, having to get to kind of the root of it a little bit is that, you know, as more and more of the content is consumed online, these media organizations are able to track that. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you have people who are keeping track of story counts, time on story, you know, how long people have spent reading those stories. And frankly, there are stories out there that are very feel-good, fluffy stories that are very positive and have great emotional stories and very powerful photography, but they're very, very positive, okay? And people tend to gravitate toward these. The numbers on stories like this are just through the roof. Now, if, you know, you're tracking a very important story in your community or nationally that has, you know, the war in Syria for all intents and purposes, and that story is not doing well and is frankly tanking, somebody's going to hit the dump button on it and say, nobody cares about Syria anymore. More fluff and, you know, teddy bears and kittens, yeah. Please.
Yeah.
A lot of the people who are making these decisions are not journalists.
Yeah.
You know, they don't come from that background. And I think they do, frankly, underestimate what the audience wants and what they're committed to.
And I'm all for, you know, for metrics. But the reality of it is that as a journalistic entity, you have a responsibility to see past that. And some of these places are losing sight of that.
Well, original journalism is really, really expensive. The news story that was generated that caused the Justice Department to you know, decide to do away with their contracts for private prisons cost over $500,000 to report that story. We had a great startup in this country a couple of years ago, Al Jazeera America. They were doing amazing work here in the United States, you know, and using their counterpart information from overseas. It just didn't survive. People weren't watching it. People weren't going to it online. And the price of oil dropped, and so the prince said, I can't afford this anymore.
Eve writes to us and says, Evan, as a British person who's lived here for 30 years, I am a U.S. citizen. Have been for years. I've always been dismayed at the news coverage here of world events. It is dismal. I have to watch BBC World News to get in-depth coverage. And says, I think it's an important topic, perhaps its own discussion separately. And Eve, I appreciate that. I do. I mean, I don't have the frame of reference that you do, certainly, but I think that's part of this discussion, from photography to journalism at large here. You know, why is it that, as Max says, we throw the dump button on something? Why is it that we need that anyway? Why is it that in Europe people are more, maybe because we're in more of a bubble here, as William says. We've had 9/11, but we don't have a routine stream of real trauma. It's a lot.
Or a history of it, for that matter.
Right,
we had the Civil War, but we didn't have World War I and World War II and all of those other wars that happened in their own backyard.
I also just want to read Maggie writes to us and says, what a great panel. Please talk photography more on this program. I'm riveted every time. Will you guys come back sometime?
This
panel here is a treasure to this community. And I say that as someone with great respect for their work and how they're educating students. And I just hope newsrooms continue to do it. I couldn't even get to all of your calls this hour. There were so many different comments that came in. I wanted to talk about that image in Baton Rouge of the woman whose dress was blowing, looking past those police officers, not the least of which is because, to Mary Howell's point earlier, she wants to say, well, when an image like that hits you, what's the solution? But that's an example of an image that some people said, look at how police are misjudging this woman and assuming she's a threat. And other people said, why is this woman not following orders of police? I mean, it's just amazing how even an image can divide people. But I guess we'll have to do that again soon.
Yeah.
Okay. William Snyder from RIT, four Pulitzers. And I think you photographed the Who. Is that also true?
Yeah.
Can we do that another time, too?
Sure.
I would love to talk about
that. Sure.
Thank you for being here. Max Schulte from the Democrat and Chronicle. You can see his work just about every day. Great to see you there. And Jen Poggi, RIT, and a former White House deputy photo editor. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
All right. More connections. We're talking another international issue, trade, next.